Like the conversations you hear on Basic Folk with your favorite roots artists? Then join Back Catalog Listening Party, a weekly podcast where you can dig deeper into their catalog. Top songwriters like Mary Gaucher, Chris Smither, Dar Williams, and Lizzie Ngo join host Mother Banjo and Anthony Earig to talk about their old albums with a live online audience. Listen wherever you get your podcasts and learn about attending live tapings at backcataloglisteningparty.com/join. Welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. Hi, I'm Cindy House. I'm the host of this podcast, and here with us today is my co-host and best buddy, Lizzie Ngo. Hi, Lizzie.
Hi, Cindy. I'm sorry that I ridiculed you in past podcasts. Today is a day of atonement for us.
No, I feel really good about that because teasing is love.
But you can't go too far with it. Otherwise, you start to feel like a bro. Don't you feel like there were moments in like the early 2000s where it was all about like Will Ferrell and Vince Vaughn and like being mean to your friends, you know?
Yeah. That was third wave feminism's death rattle.
Yeah. Guess what? We woke up new and we're back and we're for the girlies.
That's correct. If you would like to stay in touch with Basic Folk, and I hope you do, you can sign up for our newsletter, which is a once a month email, comes into your inbox and lets you know what's going on with Basic Folk, who's been on the show, who's coming up on the program, and our thoughts and feelings. You can also follow us on social media, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube at Basic Folk Pod. You can also make a contribution. We are a listener-supported operation. You can make your contribution at basicfolk.com. There are also links in the show notes for all of these things. My wife the other day read me a quote from Bill Maher, who, whatever about Bill Maher, but it was kind of like relating social media as like the new cigarettes. You know, like checking your likes is the new cigarette break.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Think what you may about Bill Maher, but I've been thinking about that one.
He is right about that. I have been working on experiencing time in a more lengthy and spacious way. And part of that has been taking less stock in social media. But it's hard, guys. It's hard. Because we like attention and we like a little cigarette buzz.
And also, the social media organizations have spent so much time and money on making these things like as addictive as possible. But, you know, follow us on social media, but take care of yourself out there. It's dangerous. Before we go any further, Lizzie, I want to say, so Casey Anderson is on the show today. Very excited about that.
It's a doozy, you guys.
And it is Halloween.
Ooh. Spooky. From a young age, I loved to wear a costume that completely transformed and created illusions out of my body. And I would make my dad build these creations that I had thought of. One year, I was like a 3D, I think this was first grade, I was a 3D wedge of cheese.
Huh.
And I was inside the cheese. It was like a cardboard contraption. I always love a Halloween costume where it invites you to imagine something else.
That sounds great.
At the moment that our listeners are hearing this episode, I am in Cambridge, England, on tour with Iron and Wine. And my guitar player, Will, and I have discussed whether or not we will do that show, this show, which is now tonight, in costume. And I haven't yet made up my mind because it would be bold. It would be very fun. We would definitely do drag in some form or fashion. And it would also be a little bit of a weird vibe to open the Iron and Wine show in Cambridge in a costume. So everybody just stay tuned for what we decide.
Ooh, you should dress up as an Iron and Wine song. Like, you could be like Tree by the River.
That's a great idea.
You could be the tree and Will could be the river.
He could be a woman and I could be a king.
Uh-huh. Oh, man. Okay, drag.
Woman King is my favorite Iron and Wine song.
It's a really freaky one.
It's so good. What a groove.
Let's get to our guest today.
Okay, I am so excited for this episode with my dear friend, Casey Anderson, not only because he's such a cool songwriter, he's a really good friend of mine, fellow Scorpio, happy Scorpio season, but because this is a type of interview that I don't think I've gotten to do here at Basic Folk. We've dealt with a lot of firsts. We've talked to artists that are like on their first album or EP. We love to talk to artists about their origins, the beginnings of things, the roots of things. This interview starts from the end. Ever since I've known Casey, his social media bio has been gradually retiring songwriter, and I'm always teasing him about what does that mean? When are you going to retire? And officially, this latest album, To the Places We Lived, is Casey's last album. And I want to put that in very heavy quotes because I hate to imagine a world where a great songwriter friend of mine is not making records. But I think his insistence on this album as the last one has more to do with saying goodbye to parts of the music industry that he wants to release and ways of being in the world that he doesn't want to engage with anymore. So that's where it all starts. Like, what do we need to let go of? What do we need to release? That's the place where this album begins. So we talk about Casey's whole songwriting career, the moment where he went surprise viral for one of his political songs, The Dangerous Ones. We talk about his time being incarcerated and what that taught him about himself, what it taught him about the world, what it taught him about white supremacy. We talk about his family. We talk about his sobriety and his work in helping others get clean and stay clean and what staying clean means in a holistic and gentle sense. The songs on this album are mournful, literate, and very, very fun. My favorite is Back to Nashville. It's the single. It's a rock and blues song. Casey's the type of artist who can write a really contemplative song about self-reflection or grief or loss, and then a blues rocker that makes you want to shake your ass in the next second. So I hope everybody goes out and purchases a physical copy of To the Places We Lived. It's a great conversation with Casey Anderson.
Should we check out that song, Back to Nashville?
Hell yeah.
All right, let's get into it. We'll hear a clip of this track, and then we will get into our conversation with Lizzie No and Casey Anderson on Basic Folk.
Sun come up this morning, sky was speckled blue and gold. Look like something I took from a dream. A 500-year-old painting, some old master never sold. Like a picture up there waiting for a frame. And I wondered for a moment about the colors that we see. How they'll disappear and everything will end. And then I settled down and listened to you breathe next to me. Let my mind go drifting back again to when you and me, we were believers, looking for the diamonds in the dust. And I made a promise I'd never leave you. I'll be with you till there's nothing left but us.
Casey Anderson, welcome to Basic Folk.
Oh my God, thank you for having me, Lizzie.
This is a long-awaited interview.
At least for you and me.
At least for us. Like, in the TMZ of our small niche artist community, this is like, I feel, has been a long time coming.
Me too.
Speaking of a long time ago, let's get into it. You grew up in Portland, Oregon, which is not terribly far from where you live now. What role has your hometown played in your life as an artist? And do you feel like your hometown, specifically Portland, is different from your broader idea of home?
Oh, we're diving right in. Okay, I'm ready.
Oh, yeah.
I'm ready. Oh, yeah. Well, I think this is a thing that that a lot of people, I have heard a lot of people in the Pacific Northwest say about living in the Pacific Northwest is that it just the climate is conducive to creation because there are 9 months out of the year where none of us want to be outside. So it's great for just like putting yourself in a room and making things to keep yourself busy and occupied. Not maybe great for everybody's overall mental emotional state, but so that, I mean, that's like a very material logistical thing that that is undeniable. Like I spent more time making things because I spent less time outside doing things.
Interesting.
In terms of my sense of home, yes, I grew up here. I grew up about 10 miles from where I currently live. I moved around a lot starting when I was 18. I went to undergraduate school in Bellingham, Washington. I went from there back to Portland, to New York, to Munich, to Dublin, to New York, to Los Angeles, to Seattle, to prison, to Portland.
And where was the prison located?
So there were two. I was in a federal detention center in SeaTac, Washington, which is right near the airport. If you fly into Seattle, you'll fly over where I was locked up. And then
let's take a minute with the poetry of that. Okay, go ahead. I like to give our listeners like a real somatic experience of sitting with a memory or an image.
Yeah, let's take a beat.
That's poetry, baby.
Let's take a beat.
Welcome to Basic Folk.
So I was locked up at SeaTac for a little over a year, and then I was finally... So federal detention centers are where people from all levels of custody are held until they are assigned to the prison that they're going to be doing their time at, or that, I mean, people are often moved without their consent or input from prison to prison. But the first prison that most folks go to is a detention center. The second prison that most folks go to is the first like prison that they're in. Right. So I went from SeaTac to Sheridan, which is in Oregon wine country, in beautiful Oregon wine country.
I think we should, we'll double back to some of these later moments. But I want to dig into origins more, like, especially as your friend, it's, cool to get an excuse to like dig into some of the like early days origin stuff that I don't know, even though we're close buds.
Yeah.
So when did you first become aware that you were a songwriter?
Oh man. Well, I mean, that's different from when I first started writing songs. I think, I don't know if it's that way for you too, because like I wrote shit for a long time that was not, okay. I don't think I've ever told this story. I think I maybe have like talked about it with buddies. When I was 18, 19, 20, I had written a set of what I thought were songs. And I was also really fortunate at that time to know Steve Earle, who was really, really generous to me with his time and with his thoughts, and he was really, really caring and kind to me. And I sent him the songs. And you know, like, and I knew, I mean, I knew who Steve Earle was, I knew what he represented.
Like, he wasn't just like your pal.
He wasn't just like my buddy Steve. Like, I knew I knew who the fuck Steve Earle was. I sent him the songs and he said, "Well, you seem to understand that songs are supposed to mean something." And that was it. And that was like, that was the feedback that he gave me. And I was like,
that was the full feedback.
That was the full feedback. And I was like, okay, cool. And he was like, you're like, you get it. Kind of.
Yeah.
You get what songs are supposed to do. You're not doing it. It was not until, I mean, I was really lucky to spend a lot of time with Steve, in my 20s. And it was not until I was like that. So I sent him those songs when I was probably like 20.
Yeah.
It was not until I was 27 or 28 that he ever introduced me to anyone as a songwriter. I was always his friend Casey when we would travel in like circles of other musicians and shit. And I had records out, you know, like I fully had like 3 or 4 records out. And he at one point was working with T-Bone Burnett and he introduced me to T-Bone as a great songwriter. And I was like, okay, I guess I must be that then. I guess I must be a songwriter now.
Right.
Then.
So even in your own mind, you didn't really feel that you were like a bona fide songwriter in those moments. I mean, like up until you felt like you had your mentor's kind of stamp. Did it feel in flux for you personally?
It felt like, I don't know if you've ever felt this way, and this is going to be like unintentionally insulting or demeaning to listeners, to audience.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But like, it just did not matter to me if I played a show and someone was like, this song is great. I would be like, what the fuck do you, you know what I mean? Like, you don't know. It's all great. Like if you play a show and you fuck up 100 times, mm-hmm. two people are going to notice that. And they're the two people. It's like the sound person and the person who plays tunes too. And so I was always like, well, yeah, it's great to you because you don't write. You don't know, you know, like you don't know.
Interesting. Yeah.
I did not feel I was seeking an external validation that I had not received. And I can recognize that now. I think at the time, you know, I think like everybody, or at least everybody who I was around, like I was on drugs a lot. I was not especially centered emotionally, mentally. So there were often times where I was like, this shit is great. I'm doing great.
Yeah.
But it wasn't until someone else said, you know, this is Casey, he's a songwriter. Like the person that I admired most in the world said, this is Casey, he's a songwriter. I was like, cool. Okay, I am. I really am.
Interesting. Yeah. That's it. Like that conversation is actually one that I think is really common when it comes to your work. You are someone that people describe as a writer's writer. Like, not to just shamelessly name drop, but the other day I was hanging out with Jason Isbell and I was like, oh, I'm about to chat with Casey Anderson. He says hello. And he was like, great writer, great writer. That's sort of like the first thing that comes to people's minds when it comes to your work, which is just, there's so many different ways to like make a career in music. You know, I think some people pride themselves on being great entertainers, great producers. And it's not that you're not those things, but I think when I think of you, the first thing I think is writer's writer. Do you think of yourself that way? And what role is like the written word playing in your songs in this period before you've decided you're a songwriter? You know, like in those early years, you're making records. Did you think of yourself as like, I'm a writer who makes albums?
Oh, that's a great question. That's a great way to think about it. Also, thank you for the compliment and thanks to Jason.
Oh, of course.
Secondhand for the compliment. That means a lot. Like you know, your song, obviously Jason's songs I admire a great deal. He's one of the best. I think that you're one of the best writers in, not just in like our circle of pals, but in...
That's not what this is.
I know. But it bears mentioning.
Thank you.
This is...
Also, hanging out was a stretch. I had a brief chat with Jason Isbell in which I mentioned you.
I will say that there are kind of, I think of my own work in three sections.
Okay, go.
So the first section is the first probably three records I made, Dead Roses. I'm not going to count the record that I sent to Steve that he was like, let me find a way to tell this kid this is horseshit.
But thank you for acknowledging that you're leaving that out.
Yeah, I'm leaving that out. So there's Dead Roses, The Reckoning, and Nowhere Nights. And I think Dead Roses is really like, I don't interact with that record. I don't engage with, like, I don't play any of those songs live. I don't. It very much is someone, I think it would take half a bar of listening to be like, oh, this is a person who loves Steve Earle.
Okay.
In every,
not
you know,
the
like,
worst thing. I no. like some records that are like that.
Yeah. But it was very much like Steve Earle karaoke with different words.
Mm-hmm, sure.
The Reckoning, I think, is a record where I started to think like, okay, I'm not that I'm not proud of the first record, but it's not me. It's like imitations of things that I like. What's a thing that's me? What's a thing that I do well? And that The Reckoning has a title track, which I'm really proud of, has Don't Look Back, which is a song that like, if people know my shit, that's a song that they know for sure. That's the first time that I thought, okay, there are some things that I can do even as a young, relatively young writer that other folks are not doing, don't seem able to do or are not willing to do or are not trying to do. And then I made the Nowhere Nights record, which is one that I do play a lot of songs from and I am really proud of, where I thought like, okay, well, how do I get good at this thing that I think that I do? You know, like, how do I go beyond being a guy who is, like, performatively clever and pretty sharp? Like, how do I make that into something that's sustainable and that's actually meaningful and that's not just, like, being cutesy for the sake of being
cute? Many in our scene would do well to listen. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak for or to anyone else, but to me, there's more to it than just, like, having people know that you're smart or know a couple words.
That and, you know some $10 words.
Yeah, and can rhyme, or that you have a rhyming dictionary. You know what I mean? And that Nowhere Nights is the record where I think people noticed me to the extent that I was aware that people were like, it was a record that got good press and there were folks at the shows and I was excited about it. And then I had some of this I can attribute to, like, mental health stuff. Some of it I can attribute to drug use. And some of it is just, like, the nature of my personality in that, like, I was like, cool, well, I know how to do that. I don't want to do that. I'm not interested in that anymore. I want to make – the next record I made had no acoustic instruments except piano. And everything else was electric. I mean, drums are an acoustic instrument. But, like, I was like, I just want to write rock and roll songs. I don't want to be a smart guy anymore. I bet I can write, like – 10, 11 super dumb, cool rock and roll songs. And I made two records kind of like that. I think Heart of a Dog, I listened to literally the other day because my daughter asked me to put it on in the car because she wanted to hear me sing rock and roll is what she asked for. I am proud of that record. I think that probably had I been more present, the songs would be a little sharper, but it did what I had hoped to do. And so that's another way in which I was like, cool, I'm a writer first and foremost because I don't only know how to write one kind of song.
Yes.
I can write different kinds of songs and I know how to do it.
That's a really, that's a good working definition for me of, like, a writer's songwriter. I really like writers that are able to write in a bunch of different genres, kind of, where it's like it means you take a delight in form.
Yeah. Very much. That's a great way to put it. And then I think Let the Bloody Moon Rise, which is the second mm-hmm. record I made with my band.
We've talked off air about how I am very sensitive about saying this word out loud. It's not for my community to say, but you're welcome to say the name of your old band.
Okay. Can I give the context that I give just to assuage my own?
Of course. Yes. Please tell our listeners.
So the band was called Casey Anderson and the Honkees. We made two records. We took the name Honkees from two places. Mm-hmm. The first is Honkees was one of the names Levon Helm wanted to give the band that they chose not to, which I guess should have been.
And I really wish we could live in a world in which they chose that name and we could all watch The Last Waltz and talk about the Honkees every Thanksgiving as a culture.
Van Morrison kicking his legs up with the Honkees.
Yeah.
I guess it should have been, like, a clue to me that if that name, like, if in the 70s, people were like, maybe not. Maybe we don't call the band that. That in the 2000s, that maybe wasn't appropriate. But the second place that we took it from was, you know, when Huey Newton was on trial, Eldridge Cleaver made buttons for white folks to wear that said Honkees for Huey.
Yes.
And I liked that. And I liked, you know, it's also a way for, I think, for me, I don't think this translated to anyone else. It was a way for me to take ownership of the fact that I feel like I said this at shows, to take ownership of the fact that we were four white guys and one black guy playing music that comes from black communities.
I feel like I've been waiting years for people to say this on the record in our music scene. So thank you for saying it out loud in your voice. I wish that it would be named. Like, I think if you are a white musician that plays, you know, guitar-based blues music, you need to be naming early, often, and loudly that you are white and that that is a concrete but ever-evolving, like, influence on your music, that it's not the default.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's like, I was having this conversation this morning with someone before this. People, like, I think you can certainly cite the Rolling Stones as an influence. Mm-hmm. I think when you do that, there's a whole other half or two thirds of that sentence that goes unspoken that should be spoken, you know? And I'll just say this and then I'll stop editorializing, but the example I gave this morning was, I knew who Elvis Presley was by the time I was like four. I didn't know who Big Mama Thornton was until I was in my late teens, early 20s, because there was nothing for me to find. And it wasn't like I was like obsessed. I didn't give a shit about Elvis. I never have.
No, but he stands as a monument to a certain type of music that emerged at a certain time. And he's also a monument to the erasure of the inventors of the form.
Right. And that erasure is ongoing. And I think that anything, as you said, anything we can do to name it, is a step toward reversing it. And it's like, I mean, it's like anything else. And again, like, I'm sorry to sidetrack this much, but I think people have to start to look outside of the systems in which we live. Like, we're not going to fix the music industry the way it is engineered. We're not going to fix music criticism the way it's engineered. We have to imagine something broader, greater, more beautiful than what we currently have. And the way that you can do that is for me to have said in 2010 or 11 and 12, to stand on stage and say, hey, this band is 80% white and we're playing blues and rock and roll. Like, we are honkies. You know, everybody except Will on the stage is a honky.
It's a pastiche.
Yeah.
As good as it can be. That actually leads me really beautifully into the next like moment in your career that I want to talk about, which is The Dangerous Ones. Now, it's a song that took some journeys from writing to release to reception to re-reception. It's a really heartfelt song. It's an album cut off of a 2018 EP.
Yep.
Is that correct?
Yeah, From a White Hotel.
And it later kind of became this viral anti-Trump rallying cry. So I have a few questions about it. The first of which is, what about the song do you think resonated so broadly with people?
I think that the folks at 11 Films who used it in their video, I think it was a good choice to use the acoustic solo performance, which is a bit more plaintive. I think it spoke to maybe what people were feeling that moment in time, which is, at least the way it was presented in the video, it speaks to a kind of rebuke of, I think, what is a communal learned helplessness on the part of most Americans, especially white Americans. And so I think in that context, what spoke to people was this idea that, you know, like, shit is bad, but we can do something about it. And that's like such a, and not, again, not to be insulting or intentionally demeaning to people, but that's such a base level understanding of what that song is. But I think, you know, in the context that like however many million people heard it and sent it around and wrote about it, that's what they were reacting to, I think, is the sense that like, oh, we're not helpless. You know, the broad reading of it is like, we're not helpless in the face of this monster person. We can vote him out, which is not what the song is about, really.
But that is what people, that is like the that's the utility that it served in that moment. And we did, the scoreboard shows that we did vote him out. So nicely done. Casey Anderson.
I love pointing to the score, like doing the scoreboard thing.
Yeah, exactly. Casey Anderson, 1. Donald Trump, 0.
Well, I have one, heard, though, because he did win the election. So
he
it's
did
like,
win. He did win. Okay.
We'll see how things go this year.
We can't get into that. We literally, I refuse to address the election on this podcast. I have a number of white male friends whose politics I largely share who have said some version of, nobody really wants to hear what I have to say right now. Like, the best thing that I can do to be a leftist, to be a supporter of marginalized people, is to like kind of lean back and not share my opinions about our political moment. As somebody who lived through this Dangerous Ones viral moment where something that you wrote was used in service of like a bigger political shift, how do you take that sentiment? Like, do you feel like you have a good sense of when it's the right time to voice your opinion, and like how you specifically as a white male musician and artist can be useful to the movement?
Sure. I will say, with all love and respect to your friends. Or I guess I will ask, because I don't want to speak on behalf of anyone. Isn't saying no one wants to hear from me just another way for me to center myself? If I make it about whether or not a person wants to hear my voice, isn't that me again putting myself at the center of, like, whether or not I'm to be heard?
I'm gagged. Yeah.
So how I try to live my politic, whether it's in art or in life, is to not speak on behalf of other people, other communities. I think that's important. It's important for me to not, like, vacuum up all the space in the conversation. I also don't think that, like, being an ally requires silence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can make a lot of noise from the back of the pack. But you can hang in the back of the pack if it's not about you. So in terms of, like, that song specifically, when I started to not feel great about people's understanding of it was when it went from, you know, we're not powerless, this is a thing we can do, to we're not powerless, this is a thing, this is the thing we have to do. You know, I think that there's a difference between contributing and being prescriptive. I think that there's a difference between, like, being an ally and centering oneself in the conversation or the movement. And I think that that song, like, any careful, close reading of that song, I think would reveal those beliefs in that politic.
Mm-hmm.
So, for me personally, like, I don't. Yeah, I'm never like, here's what we got to do for black folks. You know what I mean? Here's how we liberate Palestine.
Can you imagine with the friends that you have, you like bringing that energy? I would love to see it, actually.
Yeah. If I just was like, Lizzie, please, here's what we got to do.
Here's what we got. And I'm writing it down. Yeah. LOL.
So, yeah, I try not to do that. And I try to, like, man, I never thought in my life I would say this. Macklemore is a great example of, like, listening to folks.
Thank you.
Checking in with organizers, checking in with people on the ground, contemplating what he can do from his position that doesn't suck all the air out of the room or make it about Macklemore, mm-hmm. and redirecting every action to community.
Yes. Can I also insert that, like, Macklemore is one of the few, like, white creators in the mainstream who has ever gracefully accepted criticism and used it for the betterment of the community. Like, remember years ago when people were just, like, screaming at him for winning, you know, Rap Album of the Year over Kendrick, and, like, deservedly so. That was, like, a really ugly moment in the Recording Academy's history.
Which is what it's how high is that bar?
Right. But, like, instead of being like, you people tried to cancel me and a white guy can't say anything anymore, he kind of just, like, kept making his music and kept being in his local community. And then, like, kind of years later has popped back up just being in solidarity with Palestine. And, like, I'm sure it's more complicated than that. But I actually really admire the way he just was like, it seems like he was kind of like, yeah, this criticism isn't about me. It's about a bigger thing. How can I be useful to the bigger thing?
Yep. And so I think that that's like, I'm not, you know, we are all, I think, learning out loud in real time about so many things. And I'm far from, like, perfect or even always a great example of how to be an ally and how to be in community with people. But my immediate reaction to anyone saying, like, well, the best thing for me to do is stay silent. It's like, okay, cool. Well, you're still thinking about the best thing for you to, like, that's how you're framing it then, right? Is you. What's the best thing for you to do? What's the best thing for all? Like, how do we achieve collective liberation? That's maybe a different approach.
I love that reframing. That's so much more energizing. I'd love to shift into talking about your new kind of monumental album, To the Places We Lived. Can I start by reading the poem that your friend Kaveh Akbar attached to your press materials?
Yeah, please.
Would that be cool? Have a little reading?
Yeah, I love that.
Okay. Staying clean implies a tidy base state, No original sin sullying the garden, or us in it, the dead cheerily passing the table bread. But here, what stirs the air is the hard voice one rebukes, pathetic the way litter is pathetic, shrank and slack. Inchoate yearning, loud-bearing as a crusader's horse, the full-fed beast licking his empty pail. Now that we've run out of medicine and time, the water wheels have stilled. Men burn cities and carve moons into wooden crosses. Fenceless. Morning to midnight. Wolves howl the color of applause. A coffin is a tool, so is a song. The miracle finally fell while we painted our silver gold.
He's good.
He's really good. He's really one of the good ones. So what does staying clean mean to you, Casey Anderson, human person, right now? And then what does staying clean, the concept, have to do with the stories you're telling onto the places we lived?
Great question. Man, thank you. I'll preface it with this. I appreciate that Kaveh titled the poem that and used that language. I know that I also use that language throughout the record. In my day-to-day life, working with folks in and recovering from substance use disorder, I typically don't use the word clean to denote abstinence from substances because it creates a clean, dirty binary, which is dehumanizing. But
thank you for raising that. It's also something we talk about a lot in the reproductive justice community, that the word clean can create a lot of shame around STIs and lifestyle choices and substances and all that.
Yep. But in the course of this record, it's used as shorthand for like recovery from whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's used specifically in the record. It's used in the voice of another person telling me, the character who is me, like, this is such an autobiographical record that it'd be silly to pretend it's not me saying,
right.
You know, if you can stay clean, I can stay close. So if you can keep your shit together, then I can mm-hmm. stay next to you. Kaveh's use is, you know, feels very similar to that, or also feels like he's kind of deconstructing what the concept of clean means. So, you know, now in my life, staying clean, very much means just being alive mm-hmm. some days, you know, like staying clear of, I'll be 12 years into my recovery in October.
Congratulations.
You know, thank you very much. If that comes to pass. But there are, you know, so I don't wake up and think I want to get fucked up. There are days when I wake up and think I don't want to exist in the world anymore. And here's how I would exit the world if I were to exit the world. It would be through the use of substance. I would just do enough of the thing that I know would kill me. And so I think, you know, for me in my own life, in that context, it just means like staying connected to the things that keep me connected to the world in a way that makes me want to remain inside of the world. And that's like Hanif and I have talked about that. You know, anytime that we've appeared together, I think on stage, Hanif and I have talked about that. You and I have talked about that, both on stage and off. In the context of the album, like, not to borrow from, I mean, your record addresses a very different kind of freedom. Mm-hmm. This record for me is very much about like getting free of all of the shit that I drug around with me well after the fact. Like, I've gone, you know, like, I went to treatment. I was incarcerated. I'm out now. I don't use the way that I used, you know, or at all, actually. But, like, I identify as having recovered or being in recovery from these things. Like, why am I still, I need to shed some of this shit or I'm never going to be free of it. And it came as a reaction to, the writing of this record was very much a reaction to making From a White Hotel under the name Hawks and Doves with a band, because I just was like, did not feel cool about releasing something as Casey Anderson.
Mm. Why do you think that was?
Because I thought that I didn't think it would be cool to be like, I'm fresh out. Here's my new shit. Yeah. You
know what I mean? You're not city girls?
Yeah.
Sometimes I wish we could, one of these days we're going to do a basic folk episode where we map the Americana landscape onto the rap scene and
yes.
who is who, and that's going to be a whole good time. But sorry, back to your actual story.
Oh, man. I'm already doing that exercise in my head. I didn't feel like it was, I felt like it was presumptuous to assume people would want to hear from me after what happened. Mm-hmm. I did not have a good sense of like how many of the burned bridges were repairable.
Mm.
And I didn't, you know, I really did not want to be like, Casey Anderson is back, motherfucker. You know, like I wanted to just be like, hey, I still write songs sometimes and here's 11 I think are pretty good.
Right. It sounded like you had something to say and something you wanted to perform, but you didn't necessarily want it to be about eyes being back on you.
Yeah.
In the context of like what had happened in your real personal life.
Yeah. Yes. That's a great way to put it, that I've never even thought to put it that way. Thank you. And I think, I don't know if this is true for you, but I feel like from knowing you personally and knowing your work, like, yeah, I felt like, okay, there is a conversation happening and I have something to contribute to it. And so, mm-hmm. you know, same way that I thought, oh, you know, years and years before, oh, people aren't, I'm doing a thing with songs that other people don't seem like they're comfortable doing right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same, like, okay, well, I feel like I have a thing to contribute that not that many people are contributing right now. You know, like Dangerous Ones, a lot of it was written after the inauguration, but the genesis of that song was being incarcerated with people from the Aryan Brotherhood who took Donald Trump very seriously when everyone else was still treating him like a joke. Mm-hmm. That was like, I had a front row seat to the transition from this dude is a clown to, oh, this dude is going to be the Republican nominee for president. Like everybody was like, fuck this.
Because you were you were rubbing elbows with people that are like self-identified white nationalists. They were the ones who were like, this is our guy.
Right.
That's
right.
Not something that liberals just like threw on Trump to tarnish him.
No, no, no.
Like that's what his people were saying.
His people were like into the bit from
they
the
were like,
start.
That's our guy. He likes us and we like him. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was watching that happen and then hearing my liberal friends like deride this guy as someone who's not to be taken seriously and like mm-hmm. watching, you know, him host Saturday Night Live or have his hair mussed up by Jimmy Fallon or whatever. All this shit that we were like really, really not taking this dude as seriously as we should be. So that's how the song started. And I felt like at the time that I wrote it, at least, oh, I'm seeing a thing from a vantage point that other folks who share my beliefs are not seeing it. They're not looking in these places to see it.
I feel like that loops back to our earlier conversation where like, it seems like in that moment, the test of like, can my voice be useful here is actually a really simple one. It's like, if you see something, say something.
Yes.
It's like, if you're noticing something in your life that you feel like, and in your community and in your surroundings that you feel like people need to see, as a, like, it's like the prophetic tradition of songwriting. Like, it's our job to tell.
Yes, very much. Very much so. So that was that record. I mean, that was me,
yeah.
As you said, thinking, well, I have a thing to say that I feel like people would benefit from hearing. I don't necessarily want them to talk about Casey Anderson saying it. And
right.
Of course, what happened was like every interview I did, they were like, oh, it's prison. You, like, oh, it was great, bro. Like, what do you?
Yeah, you should try it. You should go.
And so then this record was a reaction, was me saying like, okay, I'm very far removed from my crime. I'm very far removed from having gone to treatment. I'm very far removed from my incarceration. I'm even pretty far removed from like making the Hawks and Doves record. I would like to say a last thing as Casey Anderson. You know, I would like to like kind of finish up the conversation that I started with Nowhere Nights, which is the last solo record that I made. And then mm-hmm. we took a little detour making rock and roll records or writing songs like Some Depression, which are like not, you know, not necessarily autobiographical, not narrative tunes. I want to say like a last thing to whoever is left out there that listened to Casey Anderson records and might want to hear from that person again.
The this interview is also going to be a real-time emotional reckoning that I experience where I see a friend retire. Like, since I've known you, your social media bio has been like gradually retiring songwriter. What is it going to feel like for you? Like, what is it going to take for you to feel like this album is successful? What does success look like for this album if it's your last?
That it exists. Like, I'm real close to achieving that. You know,
you did
on October 4th, it's going to be out and folks are going to hear it. Beyond that, like, I'm so, so fortunate in that I have a job, you know? Like my money, you know, I'm going to pay rent if no one buys this record, if not one person purchases this record, I'm going to still be able to pay my rent on time on November 1st.
God bless.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, knock wood. We're away from there, but so I'm very, very fortunate and really privileged in that respect, which allows me, and, you know, I said this to, a number of music friends, like, all I ever wanted from this career was to achieve the kind of freedom where I could make whatever I wanted and not care about what the reception would be and what mm-hmm. the sales would be. We're all taught that the only way to do that is to get super fucking famous. If you get mm-hmm. real rich and real famous making music, then you can make whatever you want. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, you can make whatever you want at any stage in the game. You can make whatever you want. You just have to disentangle yourself from the expectation that, you know, this is going to be the thing that drives your financial life, your material life, right?
So it's sort of like a room of one's own concept that Virginia Woolf lays out so beautifully, which is like, it's not that you need everything. You don't need fabulous success, but you need a room. And like in our setting, that means you need the money for studio time. You need to have some ideas. You need some, you know, like you need a little time, some space, some equipment, a little bit of infrastructure. And it sounds like you've hit a point where like you've achieved those basic things where your mind isn't worrying about survival, success, and failure. Your mind is focused in on the music.
Yeah. Yes, thank you. That's a good... I'm just going to have you generate quotes for me.
I'll do what I can.
Yeah, so for me, like, a successful record... we're already kind of there, you know? Like, people who I love and respect have heard the record and have said nice things. You have said really nice things to me about it. Kaveh has said really nice things to me about it. Hanif has said really nice things to me about it. Other friends who are writers have said nice things to me about it. And those are the... You know, like, my kid wants to listen to it. Mm-hmm. That's the shit that matters to me. It really matters to me what people who I admire, like yourself, if I had sent it to you and you were just like, cool, thanks, I gave it a listen, you know, I would have been like, oh shit, maybe it's not as good as I thought. Or if I had sent it to Kaveh and he had not responded the way he did or whatever. Outside of that, like, if people who are interested in hearing the record hear it, and it resolves whatever leftover stuff they had after Nowhere Nights. Because that still is the record where people are like, oh, Nowhere Nights was the thing. Then this was written very much to be like, cool. Here's the end of those stories. You know, there's 10 tunes on Nowhere Nights that are all pretty autobiographical. Here's the end of most of those stories. I hope that you feel satisfied with where these folks ended up. Mm. And I hope that you can, like, we can move on together.
Speaking of the folks in both of the album is called To the Places We Lived. Who is we?
I have thought about that a lot because another person, my friend Ray, asked me that. So we is the sort of collective people that are not just entangled in those songs, but that, like, I mean, it's very much like an autobiographical, but there's not a lot of fiction on the record. You know, there are some like details smudged or names changed or whatever, but it's the people that like I was entangled with either by choice or, you know, by way of like, I financially victimized people. There were people who I was not a very good partner to, you know, there were people mm-hmm. to whom I was unfaithful, who got dragged along in the mess of my life for a couple of years. that's the, you know, the we is my bandmates, who I was not a great bandmate to. It's my friends. It's my family. It's folks that I encountered who either got swept up in my shit by accident or who I actively courted until they were swept up in my shit and then kind of drug them along until like, oh, I'm going to prison. I'll see you when I see you. And so, you know, and that means that lived is not just like, oh, we lived, you know, I lived with this person in Greenpoint. I lived with this person in Los Feliz. I lived with this person in Seattle. It's the areas that we occupied emotionally, mentally, spiritually, collectively, in community with each other. It's all of mm-hmm. these places that we lived together that I kind of like infected in a way, you know, with my own. Yeah, you know, I was just not a healthy person. And so I think a lot of places and people became sort of momentarily infected. And this is a way of like very much making a living musical amends, very much trying to like let this be the cleaning of those slates.
Wow. What it feels like is you're describing like the reverse side of a mirror, where like today, mutuality and being in community and being interconnected and interdependent with other people is like, as your friend, one of the most special things about you as a person and as an artist. And it's the way that you're going to tell the story. Like the positive side of that interconnectedness is how you tell the story, but the dark side is the content. So how'd you put the band together? What was the community of people that like brought these stories to life?
It was, my intention was, so I talked about, you know, this being a sort of living musical amends. And and so the approach when I, from the moment I, you know, I wrote the first line of Believers, song came out this morning.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Congratulations. I love the song.
Oh, thank you. I do too. I really do. I wrote the first line of that song and I thought, okay, I have a song. And so I wrote the song and then I thought, oh, okay, this is the first song. I always write the first song first.
This
Yeah, since Nowhere Nights, I write the first song of the record, and then immediately after that, or, you know, like as immediately as is possible, I write the last song of the record, and then I think, okay, then how do I get from the first song to the last song, and what does that look like? And that's kind of like the project for me, and that's what makes it, has always made it fun, is like, cool, how do I get, I have start and end, how do I get? So I wrote Believers on...
What did I say, audience? This is a writer's writer.
Thank you. So I wrote Believers and I thought, okay, I have a record. I wrote the last, you know, I wrote the title track and then I got from one to the other. And then I thought, okay, this is clearly a record about amends and, you know, the people that I have loved and that have loved me and the ways in which maybe I failed them and the ways in which I can sort of make reparation or repair those. And so I thought, okay, cool. Well, then in that case, every person involved in this record is going to be someone, a friend. I'm not going to like hire studio musicians. And I mean, there's no reason to, like I've spent my life around musicians. And so I put Andrew McCaig and Will Moore were both in the Honkees. Jesse Moffat was in Hawks and Doves. Emily Overstreet, who played some piano, has been on a couple of my records. Jenny Conley Drizos from The Decemberists has been on a bunch of stuff. And so we did the basic tracks with that band. Casey Neal is like another friend from Portland who I've worked with before. We did the basic tracks with that band. And then I thought we were done and we started to mix. And during mixing, my dad, who had Parkinson's and Lewy body dementia, and he was diagnosed like 10 years prior. He got much, much worse. And it was clear he was not going to make it much longer. So we paused mixing. My dad passed away. Like a month later, we found out that my wife was pregnant. Thank you. And so then I was like, okay, cool. I have a kid coming. We're going to, like, I'm just going to hang this up. And when I went back to the record, it didn't feel finished to me anymore. And so then I started to be like, okay, cool. Well, this is not like, I don't have to feel defeated. This is an opportunity to involve more friends. Mm-hmm. And I just started to, like, you know, ask Dan from Counting Crows, like, here's the record. Pick a couple songs you want to put guitar in it. Ask Sadler from Jason's band. Here, same thing. Like, here's the record. And then I had so much shit, which is what was the goal. I was just like, I had, you know.
Yeah, it's a good problem to have.
Yeah. That I then, you know, called Kurt Block, who is another friend who worked, who produced the Honkees records, and called Eric Amble, who produced Nowhere Nights and mm-hmm. Reckoning and Dead Roses, and said, like, help me. Like, I'm lost. There's a million tracks on every tune. I've asked every friend I have, you know, to that point to play on this. I need to figure out, like, where the tunes are. And it really, like, I mean, it was stressful at times, but it was really a labor of love. And the whole project to me was just, like, how do I involve my friends in this? And that extended to, like, you know, Cole is doing the artwork. Kaveh wrote a poem for the thing. Hanif wrote an essay for the thing and wrote my bio. You know, mm-hmm. like any chance that I had to say, like, hey, do you want to be involved in this? I think it's my last thing. It would be really fun to do this with my friends.
Yes. And these are people who create with love. And you do hear it and see it, of course, like in this final product. Do you mind taking the time to get into a couple of songs? I bet we're going to run long today. But
I'm good with that.
Okay, great.
I'm good with that.
So I want to talk about Start Again. It talks about the circularness of time. And it feels like a song that's saying goodbye. And musically, there's a lot of space for the listener to kind of like put ourself into the song, which makes me feel like there's more to it than just a goodbye song. Can you talk about the writing behind it, like the writing process and like what you are hoping that people get from that song?
Sure. I think for me, that's a way it's sort of worked in two ways. That's me writing toward the idea that I can shed the things that I wanted to shed that we were talking about a little bit earlier and still understand that they inform not just my life, but like, I mean, it's real easy for me to be like, yo, I went to treatment, I did my time, I'm good now, you know, like I work in community with other people, I try to give whatever, whatever, whatever. That doesn't mean that like the harm that I caused somebody else, like that doesn't vanish from them.
Mm.
I don't get to like take that, be like, well, I'm done.
It's over
I'm
now.
Good. Yeah, it's over now. I'm good. I feel good with where I'm at. You know, so whether that's like a partner that I had that I was unfaithful to or lied to, or like a person that I find, you know, that I convinced to give me money and then misspent it, whatever, that they carry that for as long as they carry it in whatever the way they have chosen to or need to carry it. and so that's one of the ideas of the song is like, I can get away from this, but I can't ever get away from it.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that it's very much about like my dad and saying goodbye and like,
mm-hmm.
you know, I know that I'm not going to see physically. I know that I'm not going to see you. I will see you again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in whatever that looks like, or we will be reunited in whatever way people or souls are reunited. And I don't like pretend to have any understanding of that. And I don't have like a kind of faith that grounds me in the belief that I'm going to like die and hang out with my dad, you know, like,
yeah.
As an aside, it's always funny to me, like when a famous person died, they're like, oh, he's jamming with Prince. And like, you think that's what happens? You think like, yeah. I go up to heaven, I'm going to get to watch Prince and Jimi Hendrix.
You think they have your preferred amp? I mean, I guess that's the point of heaven, but like, what is the format of the jam has always been the type of question that I ask.
Yeah.
And it's why I probably don't get invited to.
That's why we're not going to heaven jams. There's a whole heaven jam circuit that we don't even have access to.
Listen, the entire heaven jam circuit has never had any interest for me. And here's the reason why. I have been a harp player since I was a little child, since I really did believe in heaven. And in religion class, Sister Butler talked about how in heaven, we're going to sit around on clouds and play the harp. And I was like, well, I play harp now, but I also get to like be in the world and I don't have to sit bored on a cloud. Like I'm going to have to sit in heaven and keep playing harp, but it's going to be more boring and worse. And no one cared about my concerns. And yeah. That's what pushed me out of the church. Bye.
Well, that's what pushed you out of the church. That's wild.
Yep. That was the last straw. That was pretty much my only issue with the whole institution.
Yeah. You were like, this is all good. I'm good with everything except the fact that I'm going to have to keep playing harp.
Aligns with me, but it's just like the logistics of the harp playing.
So the song, you know, the song is about having to continue to live in a cycle of things I don't necessarily want to acknowledge, but acknowledging them in a way that is graceful and done with love and care. And also, you know, looking forward to whatever cyclical thing happens after we are materially gone from this place.
And quantum physicists have recently asserted that death is an illusion. Have you read that news?
Oh, sick. I have not. That's killer.
Yeah, so there is a universe in which you and your dad are already jamming with Jimi Hendrix and Prince.
Hell yeah.
Let's talk about another song of Return, or is it? Back to Nashville. It's the single. It's a banger. It's a blues saga that could be an ancient fable, but also, like, for anyone that has spent any time in this music city culture machine, like, feels very contemporary and real. How do you think about that machine now? What are your, like, how do you feel about Nashville when you sing that song? And do you feel like there are pockets of this part of the industry that give you hope? Or are you really for seriously never coming back to Nashville?
Oh, I'll be back in like October.
Okay, great. Like,
materially, I will be back in Nashville in a couple of months, and I'll probably perform at the Five Spot, which is like...
Cool. See you there.
A fun place to chill. Yeah. What I think is that I would describe myself, this is like maybe not accurate and maybe giving myself a little bit too much credit, but I feel like I'm like the Forrest Gump of Americana in that I was always like right by the thing as it was happening. Never actually I was never the thing, but I was always like close enough to see it happening and like be there when the thing happened. And so I watched enough times that town and that industry and the genre that we work in, mm-hmm. kind of decide who got to be cool, you know? And I will say that sometimes I was like, absolute fuck yeah. You know, like,
yeah,
that's right. You're absolutely right on like, these are great songs. This is a great person, you know, like, great. And that's in the course, you know, like some friends of mine made good out there, and Lord, I'm glad they did. For real. If my friends who have had success out there, I feel like absolutely earned and deserved, in as much as in this world, those things can be earned and deserved. But like, it's like anything else where I got to a point even before I was like no longer really involved in that scene or in music, where I was like, oh, okay, well, this is supposed to be the quote unquote real, like this is the answer to the country music machine, which we are told just generates stars and teams of people write songs, and that's not authentic. And the person singing the song didn't write the song, and that's not authentic, and whatever, whatever. And it's like, okay, well,
and this is the real,
and
authentic.
This is the real shit. This is, you know, like this is from the tradition of bluegrass and folk music. And this is like, if you're in tune with what's real, this is real music. And it's like, yeah, I mean, okay, like, where do we start that tradition then? Like, who are we talking about when we're talking about where this originated?
And I will remind our listeners that we are talking about a blues song called Back to Nashville being sung by a white man. Go on. I'm going to let you finish, though.
Okay, thank you. So who are we talking about? And, like, who are the people that are making the decisions, right? Like, if it's the same 6-7 people... at the Americana Music Association, making the decisions about, at whatever publication, making the decisions about who gets to be the face of this genre, the face of this movement. Is it really all that different from country music? Yeah, like, we're not singing about backroads and beers and like short shorts or whatever, but the machination of the thing is still the same. Mm-hmm. Like, structurally, systemically, it's still the same thing. And so, like, let's not pretend. Let's just call it what it is. Yeah.
That tea is piping. I also feel like in Americana, there is like a tendency for like that thing that you're saying, like who gets to be the face of this movement? The people that are the face of the scene actually don't have all that much power.
No.
Because someone's face can be really useful.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And that's all I'll say about that.
No, exactly, exactly. You know, and again, like there are outliers and there are exceptions, and like, you know, both you and I have friends who really have made a great life for themselves writing incredible songs and have mm-hmm. been championed by folks in the Americana community, and like rightfully so. Great. It's great when the best shit rises to the top and is heard by lots of people. I'm never going to be against that, however it happens. What I am against in terms of like Nashville, the place, and Nashville, the concept or construct, is this idea that there's any more authenticity to the process of deciding who those people get to be.
Right. And that's that on that, honestly. I have an open-ended question that I want you to answer in any way you choose, and then I'd like to do a lightning round. How do you feel about that?
Feel great about both.
Okay. My last question about the places we lived, the journeys that we've talked about, as far as your being a gradually retiring songwriter and someone that works in community, in recovery. Okay, what's next?
What's next personally for me is I just keep doing what I'm doing and trying to figure out like what is good for me. And by good, you know, I'm like whatever, like let's stay away from the good, bad, always never binary, whatever. But like what is, what makes sense? What is healthy for me in my life with my family, with the communities that I work in? What makes sense for me at the place where I work? Like the, I feel like the way that I approach my work at the Alana Club of Portland is not especially different from the way that I have approached the making of this record. It's still very much like, what can I make with my friends that I think is of service to other people? So all of that feels good to me right now. I don't know if it will in a year, in 2 years, but that, I mean, what's next is like, cool, I'm in a good little groove in terms of my life and my work. Creatively, this, you know, the record comes out October 4th. I think that like every release now, the vinyl comes out like later, you know, like 2 months later or whatever. And then I get, like, I will be done with, I'll do things like this. Like, I'll do a little bit of press. I'll do a little bit of radio. I think it's like I have 6 shows this year. Probably will do 6 next year.
One with me.
One with you, which is like, again, that's the rule. Like, cool. If I can do this with a buddy who I love.
Mm-hmm. And Adeem the artist, all the homies getting together.
Yes. That's the model for me. Mm-hmm. So like, am I retiring in the sense I'm never going to like go into a recording studio again? No. I'm retiring in the sense that like, this is the last time that I'll do things that I don't necessarily want to do, in an effort to make sure that folks who maybe want to hear this or would benefit from hearing it get to hear it. I was in New York last month. I did a day in the studio with Eric Amble and a band. We recorded 2 Neil Young covers, like just set up the shit, played it live. That's done. That'll come out sometime. You know, I work with my friend Kyle O'Quinn, who plays in that band Portugal the Man.
Oh, yeah.
Kyle has a great little studio that he built in his house. Sometimes we'll go over and make shit together. That's amazing. I can do that for the rest of my life and be super happy.
I don't think you could stop doing that if you tried.
I don't think so either. I mean, like, yeah, no, I wrote, I was walking around for an hour the other day and I wrote a little talking blues song. And it's not like, my inclination was not, how do I make this into a recording? How do I release this? It was like, oh, cool. Fun that my brain still does that, even if I don't know it's going to, you know, even if I'm not like sitting somewhere. So what's next is to like really embrace the fortune and the privilege that I have, that if my brain wants to make up a song, I have the freedom to do that. And then I have the freedom to not have to ask anybody else what to do with it, to just go like, cool, I'll let this sit around for a while. And if it seems like something I can release, then maybe I'll figure out a way to release it. And if not, great. I'm glad we had that 45 minutes together, brain. You know, what a fun... I wrote a line that said something about not being as good looking as Father John Misty. That's cute. I can keep that. You know,
he's
what I mean?
So good looking.
He's so good looking. Josh is so good looking. So yeah, what's next is like not feeling tied to any not having to plan what's next. Other than, you know, I know I'm playing 6 shows this year. I know I'll play a few shows next year.
Thank you so much for being with us on Basic Folk.
Thank you. This was so like...
I am fired up about this album, and I think our audience is going to love it as well.
Thank you. It was such a... Like, this is truly an opportunity to chat with you, like a good excuse to hang out with you. And I'm glad that... I'm like grateful to be on the show, and I love hearing you talk to anyone. But like, what a fun way to trick you into hanging out with me for... for 90 minutes.
Nobody get any ideas, guys. Our schedule is very tight. This trick may not work for you.
Yeah, this trick only works if you text and say, can we
and
do
you
this?
Have a great album coming out
yeah.
on a schedule that works for Basic Folk. Okay, lightning round time. Don't think too hard. Shoot from the hip. Answer my questions.
Let's do it.
Keep it quick. Okay, what was the last book you read and loved?
Liner Notes to the Revolution by Daphne Brooks.
What is the best place for a late night snack in Portland, Oregon?
Portland, Oregon is almost entirely devoid of late night places. We're like, I don't want to call it a sundown.
Okay, how about an early evening snack?
Jojo.
Given like ideal menu conditions, what is your breakfast order?
My breakfast order has been like bagel with cream cheese for 20 some years.
Wow. What is your partner Kate's favorite song on To the Places We Lived?
Probably Believers.
What is your daughter Winona's favorite song on To the Places We Lived?
It's also Believers, and she has made up her own words to it and sings it to herself like before bed. I know.
What is your dog Ike's favorite song on To the Places We Lived?
Ike does not love my tunes. You know what Ike loves?
What?
The John Mayer song Last Train Home.
Me too.
It's a jam.
I'm on the last train rumbling. And like that really subtle Maren Morris feature, like so subtle. Okay, we can't talk about that right now.
Yeah.
What was the first record you bought with your own money?
It Takes a Nation of Millions by Public Enemy.
What was the last record you bought with your own money?
Margot Price's The Second Strays record.
So good. What is the best time of day to write a song?
Morning, for me.
And finally, what is one song you wish you had written?
Can I give two? Is that cheap?
Yes.
Lagunitas?
Who's that by? I've been hearing that one a lot on Americana Radio.
I believe by an artist named Lizzie No.
Thanks, friend.
You're welcome. And then when I heard Jason Isbell's song, Cast Iron Skillet, I was like, oh, he did it again. He did it again. That son of a bitch.
He's done it again.
He's done it again.
Casey Anderson, you've been a great guest. The new album, To the Places We Lived, is out October 4th. Thank you so much for being with us on Basic Folk.
Thank you so much for having me.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by Anthony Cabrera. Our theme song is composed by Alex Stanton. Basic Folk is on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. You can find all of our episodes there. You can search for us on the SiriusXM app under Basic Folk. Find us on Folk Alley's mobile app or folkalley.com. You can also go to our website, basicfolk.com, or listen wherever you get podcasts.
Send this episode of Basic Folk to a white guy in your life.
What if you don't know any white guys?
Congrats.
Okay, we'll talk to you next time. Thanks for listening all the way to the end. Bye.
Bye.